Today's class might be labeled a transition class. We want to finish up Revelation 17, and then we want to lay a little bit of groundwork for Revelation 18 and actually deal with the first couple of verses. Some of the things that we're going to say are items that we touched on last week. We've touched on some of these things in previous classes as well, but to just kind of make the smoothest transition that we can to go back and review a little bit and, like I say, see kind of what's ahead, because if we don't do that, we're probably going to really stumble through some of the material. It is material that's a little more difficult than what we find elsewhere in the book. But let's go back a little bit. We'll start with verse 12 in Revelation 17 and read through 18 to kind of get us the big picture, and then we'll continue to sort through some things. And the 10 horns that thou sawest are 10 kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Remember, we have two powers that we're talking about. One of the powers is evil civil government. Other power is false religion. All right, and that's still what we're dealing with here. These have one mind, verse 13, and they give their power and authority unto the beast. These shall war against the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords, King of kings, and they also shall overcome that are with him that are called and chosen and faithful. So that's the basic picture. We've got the Lamb and his people on one side. We've got the devil with his two key helpers, false religion, rebellion to God, evil civil government on the other side. And that is the overriding theme here. Verse 15, and he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the harlot, false religion, rebellion to God, where the harlot sitteth in peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues, and the 10 horns which thou sawest and the beast, these shall hate the harlot and shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and shall burn her utterly with fire. For God did put in their hearts to do his mind and to come to one mind, and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be accomplished, and the woman whom thou sawest is the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. As you try to sort through a lot of that information, again, we kind of have the big picture. The best that I can do with that is that you have here, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, you have here for a time a period of partnership. And whether this occurred in the past or whether this occurred in John's day, whether this may be still something that is in the future for us, that's open to debate. I'm inclined to think that we've had examples in the past of this and that at some time in the future we might not be surprised if this happens again. But at least for a time, the picture seems to be you've got evil civil government, and it decides that it wants power. Well, government just seems to lack power as you look at different places throughout the world. So if you want to increase your power, your civil authority, what are you going to possibly reach out to increase your ability to control people and things? All right, let's somehow bring on religion. Well, Rome did that with the emperors and with the pagan temples that they had. So you bring on religion. And I'm going to say this a couple more times throughout the class, but you know, sometimes, let's put it in terms of a marriage. A person says, oh, I've got to marry this person. This is the right person for me. Well, little time passes and they get married. But what happens after 6 months, a year, 5 years? Oh, what was I thinking? That's the worst decision I've ever made. And now I've got to get a divorce. People sometimes so can't stand their partner, they try to kill them. Hire a hitman to go and knock off the wife. Hire a killer to go and knock off the husband. Do you think evil civil government can get to that point as well? Let's bring on board religion. Look at all the power that we're going to get. But what might happen to that relationship with time? Just like marriage, she's no longer attractive at some particular point in time. And Stan had talked to me a little bit after the class last week and made this point as well. When you look at politicians today, they will go out and they will get a person or get an organization, use them for a while until they get what they want. And after they've got what they want, they've got their power, they've got their wealth, they've got their connections, then what happens to that political tool that they brought on board? What? That's right. What's the old expression? They throw them where?
Under the bus.
Throw them under the bus. Well, that's really what we see in Revelation chapter 17. You have evil civil government, they partner with religion for a while, and then they decide to attack it. Let's throw them under the bus. And they go so far, as you look back to verse 14, what else do they do? They even, evil civil government, goes to the point of making war against the Lamb. Now, whether that's a direct attack on Christ or maybe it's just a simple way to describe, God and His people, God's will, whatever it is, but there is an all-out onslaught against religion. Well, as all of this is taking place, it looks like this is complete rebellion to God's will. I mean, it looks like Satan has really gotten the upper hand. But as you look at the last couple of verses here, what's John saying? Verse 17, for God did put into their hearts. Whose hearts are we talking about? The good folks or the bad folks? The bad folks. John says God put into their hearts to do what? To fulfill his will. Now to us, that's amazing. At least it is to me. That here you have evil people, they're out there working their will in the world, and God says, as you look at the overall scheme of things, yes, they have free will, yes, they're making these evil, these terrible, these awful choices. But at the end of the day, they're doing their will, but this also accomplishes my will. Well, we can see that, I think, from a couple of perspectives. What's God's will when it comes to false religion? Let's promote it, let's be happy about it. No, God's will is, it's not a good thing, and I'm not that enthused about it. So here it's being attacked, and there is some benefit to that. We talked last week a little bit about this principle to a certain degree in the Old Testament, the book of Jeremiah 25, verse 9, I mentioned to you, and we figured out that Nebuchadnezzar, that Old Testament king, he was not a friend of God, and yet Jeremiah 25, 9 says that Nebuchadnezzar was God's servant. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was doing his evil stuff that he wanted to do, but God says, as you look at the big picture, what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is my will. Another one. You think that Judas was acting of his own accord? The fellow who betrayed Jesus? Oh, all right. He made that choice. The devil comes along, enters his heart. So Satan, we'd say that he also was doing his will, the devil's will. But okay. Yes, right. You've got free will. So if you're going to do this, go and what you do, do it quickly. You have the ability to choose. You can either go and do it, or you have the ability to refrain and back up from your choice. So you make the decision and select what you want to do. And yet, as you look at Acts 2,
still accomplished God's will.
Yeah. Acts 2, going back to eternity, God says that this was, that Christ would die. This was God's plan. And then you also have that specific statement in Acts chapter 4, verses 26 through 28. So very, very interesting. Now they're in the middle of verse 17. God put into their hearts to do his mind, things that we just talked about, and to come to one mind. This expression, one mind, is interesting because it was used in secular Greek writings to describe political agreement, to describe political accord, political unity, if you will. And that is consistent with what John is describing here by using this technical word. You have a union, which is temporary. And whether you interpret that as past, present, or future, we'll say more about that hopefully a little bit later on in the class. But you do have this temporary alignment between these two hostile forces, and that eventually comes apart, and there is, like I say, an all-out onslaught against religion and spiritual things. And that is going to happen, because as you look at verse 17, he says there at the end of the verse, until, as all of this stuff unwraps and unfolds, God says, until the words of God should be accomplished. So heaven does have a plan. As John talks about this, we don't have, I guess, enough information to definitively say it's past, it's present, it's future, or maybe it involves multiple times. Based on what I said last week and what we'll see again today about Revelation 18, some introductory comments, I think that the principle, at least my current thinking on it, which may or may not be right, is that we've seen this in the past, and this may be one of the things that helps us get some sense of what society may be like when it's time for the Lord to return. We've talked about that a little bit in the Matthew 24 class on Wednesday nights. But we do know God rules in the kingdom of men, the kingdoms of men, Daniel 5:21. Other passages in the Old Testament make that particular statement. So John's describing here a great downfall, and really a great emphasis is made on false religion. Verse 18 also deals with... I'm sorry.
I didn't hear you mention that.
Okay. For God did put into their hearts to do his mind, and to come to one mind, and to give their kingdom unto the beast.
Oh, it does say that.
Yes.
Oh, okay, I didn't hear you
Okay, I may have gone through the text a little too quickly, or maybe I missed a line. But and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be accomplished. And here you have to give the kingdom, political kingdom. Who are they going to give it to? They're going to give it to the religious folks. Because again, well, we'll work through you and so forth. But then that takes us back to that relationship issue that I described. Sometimes people feel like they've got to have this partner, whether that's a marriage partner or a secular partner, but then the relationship sometimes becomes distasteful and they just can't wait to sever it. And this seems to be what John is describing here. Okay, verse 18, this relates to some of what has already been said. You have evil civil government. They, just as Bonnie brought out, they yield their power, they yield their authority to apostate faith. And that's also kind of what we saw back there in verse 13. He says, these have one mind. And once again, this refers to the political powers. They have one mind. There's that political agreement, because this is a technical word for that. And they give their power, they give their authority unto the beast. It is, we're going to submit to you and do what you want. Well, that kind of relationship can be long-term, it can be short-term, it can be full, it can be partial. And in this case, it's virtually full in every sense, but it is something that is going to be short-term. And you know, to us, short may mean 6 months or a year. How the Bible defines this, a little more difficult. Back in Revelation 12:12, John said that the devil had a short time. Well, that short time has turned out, from our perspective, to be a long time. So this state could be one that exists for a long, long time. Thus, if we get down to a time where society is very anti-God, anti-secular, we would say, well, this is at least consistent with what John has described, and maybe the world's going to see a few more periods of this. I do think it's interesting to look at our day and time, though, and we're not really to the point where, you know, I think Revelation 17 seems to describe as far as the fullness of it, but we do see a lot of emphasis on secular activity, a lot of emphasis on anti-God activity, and we have at least some sense of what a world like that, if it's filled with it, is going to be like. So very, very difficult time for God's people, but John says you persist, because the devil and his helpers, this stuff is going to be temporary. Anything you want to add or ask before we say some comments on Revelation 18? Don?
This is a reference to Acts 2:23.
Mm-hmm.
It's talking about Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. It's talking about Jesus going to the cross and rising on the third day.
Mm-hmm.
But the reference would indicate that this could be a broader umbrella for everything that God that happens as God's plan.
I would say so, sure. I mean, when you look at God, it's his world. We sometimes sing, this is my Father's world, and I believe that's exactly right. If you flip over to Acts 4, isn't it going to be... You can start with 25. Who by the Holy Spirit, by the mouth of our father David, thy servant, did say, why did the Gentiles rage? The peoples imagine vain things. The kings of the earth set themselves in array. The rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his anointed. Well, again, whenever that describes, Acts 2, I think, is probably the primary time where you've got the day of Pentecost and what led up to that, those kinds of things. But you do have people at various times throughout human history trying to array themselves against God, and that's really what we see in Revelation 17. He says in 27, for of a truth in this city, against thy holy servant Jesus, whom thou didst anoint, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel foreordained. Notice that. These rulers, to do what you foreordained. They had free will. And yet, the very point that you were making, God rules in the affairs of men. The things that happen, and to me, as far as trying to put my mind around that, that is way above my mental ability to process it. But God says, this is my world. Well, think of it in these terms. Matthew 10, Jesus said, are not the very hairs on your head numbered. Now that gets down to some pretty minuscule stuff. You know, God says the cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. You think he knows how many ants are alive right now? Sure. Well, I mean, who cares from our perspective about that kind of stuff? Who cares how many blades of grass there are? You know, who cares how many dead pine needles there are in the world? Well, for us, those things are really insignificant and probably not all that important. But God says, yes. You know, when I speak about being in control of the world, when I talk about being on top of things, that's true in the absolute sense.
So, if you apply that to like the Muslim world, where it's the Muslim government, and the Muslim government, Muslim religion, and they persecute Christians, kill Christians, it's hard to put your arms just as it is.
Yeah. Well, when we talk about God's plan, remember that there are some things that he tolerates, and there are some things that are his specific will.
How do you determine which is which?
There are some cases where I think we can make some determinations, either through his word or common sense, but then there are going to be some other cases where we look at it and we have to say we don't have enough information to make a determination. But when we think about God's will, for example, if you have, for example, let's say that you've got two Christians. The husband is not so faithful, he's a wife beater. Well, we would not, it's God's world. Does he permit that to happen? Well, obviously, if the man's able to smack around his wife, he does. But is that God's will? Well, no, love your wife as your own body, Ephesians 5 and so forth. So he's permitted that, but he's not authorized that. So if we think about the situation with the Muslims, here we have the persecution of Christians. Is God permitting that? Yes. Is that his will? No. His will, when you think about Matthew chapter 7, summed up, the golden rule is you treat people as you want to be treated. Well, if you don't want me to chop your head off, what do you think the right behavior is for you to respond towards me? You don't chop my head off. So that would be an example of using the scriptures. But when we think about God's will, we can put it at least in those two categories. So good question. Anybody else? Let's turn to Revelation chapter 18. And this goes, again, back to some of the things that we talked about briefly last week. Now, we've said before, Revelation, there are some parts where we can look at the material and be really confident as far as what's being said, at least with the general picture. And there are some other things which are a lot more difficult. And here in Revelation 17 and 18, we have some difficulties. Great caution needs to be used throughout this book, and here is another example of that. When we think, and we see a little bit of this in Revelation 17, but when we think about things, generally speaking, we think about things in a very sequential or logical way. For example, if we say 1, what do we think next? 2. We generally don't say, 1 and then 6 and then 99. We might say 1, 3, 5, 7 if we're doing odd and even numbers. Or if we say A, then we expect B. We don't expect somebody to go from A to D. If we saw an outline like that, we would say, there's some stuff missing. When we look at the book of Revelations, because of how we think, that real linear kind of thought, we're tempted, I think, most of the time to think that, John probably constructed his point in this way. But that's not what we find. And I gave some examples of this last week as far as just calling out some information, but let's look at it now. Let's quickly look at some things in the chapter. Revelation 18:2. And he cried with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." As we look at that passage, what does that suggest as far as the verb tense? Is it past? Is it present? Is it future? Fallen, fallen. All right, sounds like it's collapsed. It's gone. It's done. It's history. Well, now, bearing that in mind, it's past. Let's look at verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Do what? Come out of her." Well, how do you square that? If it's fallen, if it's toast, if it's flat, you would think that you would come out of her when? You come out, if a house is going to fall down, if a building, is going to collapse, you come out before it collapses. So he switches very quickly from the past tense to the present tense. And then let's look at verse 9. And the kings of the earth, he says, who committed fornication and live wantonly with her, this is the same group, the same power, Babylon, they what? They shall weep. That's future. If Babylon has fallen, past tense, then those fellows should have wept or been weeping. But that's not what he says. He says they shall weep. Shall reap. Not reap, but weep. They may have reaped some bad stuff too. And then as you look at verse 11, let's go back there. And the merchants of the earth, now it's present tense, they weep and they mourn over her. As you look at verse 18. And cried out as they looked, past tense, upon the smoke of her burning. And then as you look towards the end of the chapter, Revelation 18, verse 21. And a strong angel took up a stone, as it were a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, "Thus with a mighty fall shall." Well, isn't that confusing? First part of the chapter, it's done, it's over, it's finished. End of the chapter, he says, it shall be overthrown. My explanation for this last week was, and I still think that this is the best explanation that I can offer, is that he switches around the tenses, perhaps to indicate to us that what's going on here is not necessarily related to one point in time. So there have been situations, certainly as we look at past history, and it may not have been as universal as what may occur in the future, but there have been times where the way of Babylon has created some difficulties, and the kinds of things that we see in Revelation 17 and 18 have occurred. Presumably some of this was taking place in John's day, and as we look at it, it seems to me that there are some indications, and as I said, some of this goes back to what we talked about in the Matthew 24 class, that this may be what we find a little bit later. As you go back and you look at the idea of Babylon and its fall, this is something that is a big deal in the book of Revelation. Let's flip back a couple chapters. It's easy to kind of forget where we've been because there's so much stuff here. Let's look at Revelation 14:8. And another, a second angel, followed saying, what's this angel's message? Babylon again. This is where it starts. And he says two times, it's fallen, it's fallen. It's great, and it's guilty of some bad stuff. It's made all the nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of fornication. So in 14:8, the fall is announced. And as you go back and you look at this, you'll find in Revelation 16, another reference to that. I had the passage there in, 16:19. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered in the sight of God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So Revelation 14:8, Revelation 16:19, and then we also have this in Revelation chapter 17. It's also continued in Revelation chapter 18, and we just continue on with it. Why do you think, and you can put it in terms of things that we do in secular life, why keep coming back to this? Babylon, it's bad, it's fallen, it's going to be destroyed. Babylon, it's bad, it's fallen, it's going to be destroyed. I just keep repeating the point.
It existed then, and it exists now.
All right, I think that's part of the point. We can take it a step or two further. Anybody want to add a little bit more? You have a child. You tell them something once and you forget about it. But then you have a child and you tell them once, twice, three times. Tell them throughout his life. How come? All right, here is something that is so critical. Here is something that is so important. The child may be severely damaged or the child may be killed if he does not get that information. It seems to me that this is what John is doing with the subject of Babylon. One suggestion is this. He says this matter must be indelibly marked on the mind. The fall must be remembered. And that's important for us, I think. As we look at this world as a system, false religion, we can say, look at how powerful it is. God comes along again and again and says, Babylon, even though it looks so powerful, so massive to you, what's the message? Its fall is going to occur. In fact, he even describes it, as we mentioned, from Revelation chapter 18 with the past tense. The source I'm citing also go on to say it must be wanted, it must be longed for. They must almost be impatient for it, so that when it finally comes, it will be relished and absorbed. And as I said, we went back to Genesis 10, we went back to Genesis 11 to talk about Babylon, where the story really begins, and we pointed out four truths associated with Babylon, four things that it represents, and a big part of it is false religion. So sometimes as we talk about Babylon, we just sum it up in that particular way. Anything that you want to add or ask before we start with the text, Revelation 18? Betty? Yes, I would agree, and it's almost like a tug of war. If you've ever participated in a tug of war, you got people on both sides, and this side is successful for a little while, and the other side is successful for a little while, and it kind of goes back and forth. But in this case, God says, I'm standing by the rope, and at the right time, what am I going to do? Well, he's going to do that, but initially he's going to grab the rope and say, the game's over. And I've got my people. They're on this side of the rope. And the other folks, the rope, as you mentioned, is going to be cut, and you're going to be tossed away. But you're right. There is that seesaw effect. There is that back and forth that continues throughout the Christian era. And it's evil on the one side, all the things associated with it. Righteousness on the other side, all the things that are joined with it. And sometimes the side, just like tug of war, if you've ever watched this, if you've ever participated, sometimes one side, they're doing really well. For a long time, they've got the upper hand. And that goes back and forth. Sometimes evil, it looks like it has the upper hand. Sometimes it's good that it seems like it's doing very well. But there's that back and forth tension. Economies do that as well. You go back and you look at the people who lived through the Great Depression, they would say, we were down here at the bottom. We've had some other times where people have been very prosperous, but it's also true in the spiritual realm, as you mentioned. Stan?
And I think I agree with that point entirely. Back to what Don was saying a little earlier, it's like you could also look at it as, okay, there's a lot of ups and downs, but then there's the overall long-term, and when it says Babylon is fallen, you can take that to the bank. In other words, it's God's way of saying, I don't care what happens this whole time. When it's all said and done, Babylon's gone. She's fallen. And so there's kind of two different ways there that you can look at.
Yes, there's our perspective, which is, we mentioned, is kind of the seesaw, it's the back and forth. But going back to Don's point, you've got God's perspective. And he's got that overriding perspective, eternity to eternity, which is not literally true, but that's the best way that I can describe it, where we are bound by time. And God says, okay, it's flipping back and forth, but ultimately I'm the one who's in control, and it is going to fall. This is the way that things are going to turn out in the end. So you need to stick fast and not depart from the faith. So we need to bear in mind heaven's view of it.
It's kind of hard for us to look at that tense in that respect. But God can look at it and say it is fallen, even though at the time the people are suffering because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are a lot of imperfect examples that we could give of that. For example, somebody comes up and they see a rock. Well, okay. Some guy pays $10,000 for the stone. Well, what are you doing with that? Why would you pay that much for a chunk of marble? The guy, and again, not a perfect illustration, but the sculptor can actually see. You think about Michelangelo. He can see what that's supposed to be. Not literally, but he's kind of got it in his head. So, imperfect illustration for God. We're kind of that fellow that looks at the piece of rock and says, well, what's going on with this? But, as a chip here and a chip there happens, well, okay, I can start to see a little of what you're doing, and then the other fellow has the whole thing in hand. Don?
Change of tense. You probably already covered this, maybe I didn't hear it. But Babylon, basically, does it represent Babylon, the end of time? And Babylon represents all the sinners?
If you go back, as I said, Revelation 14:8 is really where John starts to talk about Babylon. And Babylon, you've got false religion as far as part of that, and really rebellion to God. If you want just kind of a one-sentence summation of it, Babylon means rebellion to God. Now, some of that rebellion is spiritual rebellion, and that seems to be a big thing in the book. But there are certainly some other things. When you think about the people of Babylon, let's go back to Genesis 10 for a second, Genesis 11. We've said many times that John uses the Old Testament or Old Testament stories, images, to talk about things related to the New Testament. We've got in Genesis 10, verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Well, as you then take that information and you look at Genesis 11, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick of for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower. Well, anything necessarily wrong with that? Let's build a city. Now, people build cities all the time. Anything wrong with putting up a tower? Nothing wrong with that. But then people started to head in a different direction. Whose top may do what? May reach to heaven. Problem with that?
Be like God.
And now that becomes an issue. And then he says, let's do what? Let's also make for ourselves a name. Let's go ahead and become important. Lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. Well, what was God's will for people? All hang out there in city A?
Multiply.
Okay, multiply. And implied in that was what? You go out and you diversify. You go to various parts of the earth. So here is God's express will, and what do we find the people doing? Rebelling. We're not going to do what God wants. And God comes down to see the things, and verse 6, behold, they are of one people, they all have one language, and this is what they begin to do. Now, then nothing is going to be withholden from them. So as I say, if you want to sum up Babylon, false religion is part of it, but rebellion to God is a key aspect of that as well. So when John picks up this image and starts talking about Babylon, you've got one power, evil civil government, you've got the other one represented by Babylon, and that rebellion to God, much of which is spiritual.
Well, I was thinking that if Babylon being an umbrella of everything that was on the other side of the line, of the rope, that's going to end.
Yeah.
Because it says within an hour, it almost indicates at the end of time.
And that's where I think, and that's with the Matthew 24 class, we'll see if we get that today. We had this conversation with Bonnie last week. I do not want to ever be put in a situation where Brad is predicting the end of time. We're in the final days. And she wasn't saying that. And I want to be clear, I'm not trying to say that. But there does seem to me to be, in the Bible, some indications, we'll talk about these again, that suggest, and Jesus, you know, comes out and talks about this in the context of being ready in Matthew chapter 24, where he compares his coming to the time of Noah. Well, as I go back and look at that, what was the time of Noah like? Well, you had people who were not ready for the flood to come. They'd not made the right preparations, so they're outside the ark, and they die. That seems to be one of the big points in Matthew 24. But also, as you look at verses 36 to 39 of Matthew 24, you have to give consideration, I think, to what the time of Noah was like. You know, there's Noah. He's out preaching. What impression do you get as far as how many people want to come out to the tent meeting? I don't know that they had a tent, but we are soon. Not too many. They're eating. They're drinking. They're giving their hand in marriage. They're consumed with the secular things of life. Well, that seems to be consistent with what Jesus describes about his next and final coming. I mean, if you've still got Bible study prospects in the world, and God doesn't want any people to perish, it seems to me that you'd have to conclude that he's not going to come, because there are still some people who want to become Christians. But when you've gone through and you've harvested everybody from the earth that's willing to become a Christian, I mean, we used the illustration before of a strawberry patch or blackberry patch. After you pick the patch clean, there are no berries left. You know, do you just continue to go out there and, you know, stand around in the patch? I mean, there's no sense in that. So when you put all that information together, it seems to me that he's saying that a time like Noah is going to come, when that's going to occur, but ultimately it's going to describe a time where it's a very secular environment. Now, I'm not going to stake any money on that. I'm not going to stake my life or salvation on that. But that is the picture that seems to emerge from Matthew 24, Luke 18, verse 8, Revelation 17 and 18.
So you're saying, not put words in your mouth, but as long as their fruit be harvested, whether it's ripe or not, or close to ripe, that the end time will basically not be here, will not come.
I'm inclined to conclude that. Now again, do I want to stake anything on that? No. Do I want anybody to go away and say, well, Brad thinks the end of time can't come today? No, because I don't know the hearts of people in the world. But when you look at that passage in 2 Peter 3, God is not willing that any should perish. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him. God is in the business of saving people. If that's true, and there are still people in the world that are willing to be saved, they just need to hear the gospel, then I can't answer how the Lord could return, when if he would have waited another day, a week, a month, a year, and that person would become a Christian. I can't reconcile those two things. And that's one of the things that logically that takes me back. You know, again, you have to go back to Revelation 14, verse 8. Or I think it's 18. This is another passage. 17 says, and another angel came out from heaven, which is in, came out from the temple, which is in heaven, and also having a sharp sickle. And another angel, this is 18, came out from the altar, he that hath power over fire, and he calleth with a great voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, send forth the sharp sickle, this is the end of time, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for the grapes are what? They are fully ripe. We're not going to get to it today, but I'll give you a little preview. When you look in the Old Testament, You find a principle where God says to a certain group of people, a nation, the Amorites would be one example of this. Sodom and Gomorrah, we gave this example. Teresa gave this example a couple of years ago. I'm not going to move ahead. That's going to be too far off base. But he waits until a certain time, and he uses the image of a cup. God says, your cup is now full. There's not room for any more. And when that cup of iniquity, when that cup of sin was full, then God says, I'm going to act. That would also be consistent with this principle that God has, you know, exhausted every possible thing. The earth has been completely cleansed, the people who are willing to do what's right. And then sometime, and I'm not saying, again, even if you go that far, you know, that's not to say that, well, okay, this last person has become a Christian and bang, now the Lord's going to return. He could wait for a while longer. I don't know. But that does seem to describe the state of time the best I can tell. So all those caveats in there, that's what you can put me down for. Stan?
Well, we have to be very careful. Because if you look at the example that he used, the time of Noah, when all of these things were happening, when as a human being, we might stand back and say, okay, the world's done. We can't tolerate this anymore. But he didn't destroy the world. He saved Noah. So, Bishop, come in. Use that example of Noah and the way things happen. We, if you want to project that forward, can stand here and say, oh, everything is as it was in the day of Noah. He's certainly going to destroy. But we still don't know that because he saved Noah and his family.
Right.
So,
yeah. And two, I get the impression that Noah preached really up until he went into the ark. He didn't have any impression from or any indication from what I can tell where God said, okay, there's going to be 10 more years left and the people are not responding. There was no way for him to know who was going to respond and who was not. And we're in that same boat. We can't read minds. Let me toss this out. Betty had asked a question, not to put you on the spot, but you'd asked a good question about 6 weeks ago when we were in Matthew 24. You had talked about people today saying we can't know the season, or we can't know the exact hour, but we know the season. I'm still not real comfortable with that, and I don't think that's true because we can't know what's in the minds of people. But let me point this out for your consideration, and I don't want to put too much emphasis on this, but think about what Jesus said concerning his next and final coming. He said we can't know the day, and we can't know the hour. That's interesting to me that he worded the point in that way. He could have said, you just can't know. He didn't say that. He said, you can't know the day, you can't know the hour. Now, a lot of people would say that, well, we can pick out the season. Well, as we said from the book of Revelation, though, what's been true throughout time? We've got examples of history where it looked like, especially without pre-internet, it looked like the whole world was secular. So people could have said, well, look at this. This is the time and this is the set of circumstances, so the Lord's got to come soon. Well, they would have been wrong. And today, we're still going to be wrong. But when you go back and you think about that, the day, the hour, and then you begin to put this information with Revelation 17, and that's why I say I'm not willing to stake anything on it, but the impression that you get is that there's going to be a very anti-God world, a very secular world. Because if that were not the case, if there are still people out there that are going to become Christians, wouldn't you want the Lord to hang around another day or two until you got converted? Well, I would. And surely he does as well, because he doesn't want a single person to perish. So make sure you're listening carefully. Don't attribute anything to me that's wild and wacky, because we're not trying to go there. We're not trying to predict the end. But we do want to try to lay this out in a sensible, logical, and biblical way. Don? And then Stan.
Well, I assume, the assumption is that the time Noah started constructing the ark was not overnight. It was several years.
Yeah.
And the assumption is that there were no other people other than his family that answered his call. So that's a period of time.
Yeah.
And then another thing is, if God measured the time the way we measured it, yeah, maybe we could see the season. But a season could be thousands of years from now.
Yeah.
From the time the fruit forms on the tree until it's plucked,
yeah,
it could be thousands of years. So the time span, we can't relate to that.
Exactly. But when he does come, the picture does seem to be that the world's not going to be a very pleasant place. But we could make that argument now. So, I mean, could he come today? Sure. Because we see a lot of stuff that is just like what John describes. So, again, we're not trying to pinpoint the coming, but we are trying to tie this into what John describes. in the right way. Stan?
Well, to go back maybe to help you a little bit, what you're trying to tell us is this is what the end of time is very likely going to look like. Now, it's kind of hard to separate the two, but that is not being predictive. That's simply saying that's what it's going to be like. And so, as you emphasize, you're not saying when this happens, the end of time is going to come. You're saying it in reverse. In the end of time, this is what it's going to look like.
Yeah. That's the conclusion that I've come to. Again, I'm not going to stake my life on it, or even a dollar on it. But that seems to be consistent with what we find here in Revelation 17 and 18. All right, Benny? Thessalonians.
Thessalonians, the second coming, that those that are
alive,
that are following God, will be taken up. So even though we are here, or whoever at the time of his coming, that are still practicing Christians, there may be quite a few on the earth that are still practicing Christians. And the rest of the world, you know, is bad. Mm-hmm. And only Christ, or only God, rather, will know whether there is a one or a two or a third person out there that would, if he waited another day or two, come to him. He's going to know that there's going to be no one there. So there may still be quite a few Christians on earth.
Right.
At the time of his second coming, but yet the rest of the world, I mean, we think, look at it and say, you know,
nobody's left.
Well, we look at it and say, well, we don't know whether this child here is going to grow up to be a Christian, but God knows whether that child is going to grow up to be a Christian.
We've shown a lot of times from the Old Testament how things in the Old Testament point forward to the New, and I'm still doing that as possible on Sunday nights. And one of the things that you see with that, the Old Testament repeatedly shows how God had a righteous remnant. Even when it looked like everybody had, you know, gone into apostasy, he still got a righteous remnant. That seems to be one of the examples that points forward to God also having a righteous remnant. And that's what Paul affirmed in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 and 17. Then we that are alive, when he comes, we're going to be caught up together with him to meet the Lord in the clouds and be with him forever and so forth. So yes, how many people that is? But if you've got a world that's got a trillion people, and you've got 100,000 who are Christians, still, that's a very small number. We don't know how many people were in Noah's day, but you've got 8 who are saved on the ark. But that principle is consistent with the word few in Matthew 7, 14, and 15, not only at that time, but also when you take all the people throughout eternity compared to the number who are saved and lost. Glenda, quickly. Okay. Well, you could make a couple of comparisons there. The first one that comes to my mind would be, again, think about the numbers. Compared to the people who were saved, what was the number of the lost? The people who got torched?
A lot more than what was saved.
Yeah. You know, you've got, you know, just a handful that start heading out, and you've got the cities of the plain, Sodom, Gomorrah, some other cities, communities in there. And probably, you know, we're not dealing with tens of thousands, but still, the number of people who were righteous compared to the number who are not, very, very small.